This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Thanks for joining us. It's been well established that Mound Key in Estero Bay was home to the Colusa Indians for more than 1,000 years. And now new research, just published in the journal Historical Archaeology, finds that Mound Key was also the location of a short-lived Spanish fort built in 1566, known as Fort San Antón de Carlos, which was home to one of the first Jesuit missions in North America. The Colusa were a politically complex group of fisher-hunter-gatherers who resisted European colonization for nearly 200 years in all. They used shells as tools and for jewelry and discarded the fragments in large mounds. On today's show, we're joined by one of the study's lead authors and the former director of the Randell Research Center on Boquilla, which is the home of Colusa Indian archaeology and history. Let's hear that now.
I'm Bill Marquardt, an archaeologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History at the University of Florida in Gainesville, now retired.
So a bunch of my friends that are into archaeology and history suddenly started posting things about this yesterday and the day before on Facebook. So you were saying that this is research that's been going on for quite some time, right? Can you just kind of go back to when you first got involved and I guess what the conventional wisdom was or what archaeologists thought back when that began?
We knew about Mound Key for a long time. And one of the surprising things is that very little work had been done on Mound Key. And people believed that it was the capital of the Colusa. We were not the first people to think that. But people had not actually identified the location of the king's house, which was said to be able to hold 2,000 people without being crowded. And they hadn't actually located the place where Fort San Antón de Carlos was located in the 16th century. And so we set about to try to establish that these things that people thought were really true. The work at the fort itself was in May 8th to June 1st, 2017. That was the field work. Of course, analysis goes on. There's a lot of preparation that goes before you go to the field. But that was when we worked on it, 2017. And then the article just came out recently, and then the publicity came as a result of the article.
So the Spanish had a fort here at Mound Key that we suspected was there, but we didn't know for sure. Did the Spanish keep good records? I mean, did we know that just from historical reading, or how did we know or think we knew that?
There are good documents in this particular case. One of the things that has been particularly informative were the letters and records of Juan Rogel, who was the main priest at Fort San Antón. He was there not when Menendez landed in February 1566, but not too long afterwards. He was assigned to that fort to try to convert the Indians to Christianity. Of course, if you can imagine, if you're a Spanish speaker coming into an island where no one speaks Spanish, that would be difficult to communicate. But fortunately for the Spaniards, there was a man named Hernando Escalante Fontaneda. And Fontaneda had been captured as a young boy in 1549 and had lived among the Colusa as a captive. And so he was able to translate for Juan Rogel and others and Menendez with the Colusa Indians. So he played a very important role as the translator and kind of go between the two cultures. And then Fontaneda himself later, around 1575 in Spain, wrote a memoir about the Colusa, and he describes many things about them. So there are key records that that did shed some light on this. When you just have documents and no archaeological data to back up those documents, You're not in a position to account for any of the biases. It's all historical documents, whether we write them or someone else writes them, are written from a particular point of view, either justifying what actions were taken, justifying what went wrong and how whose fault it was, any number of different things. There are biases, religious biases. There's cultural biases, racist biases, if you will. And so by doing archaeology in places where we have historical records, the archaeological data can kind of balance out and the biases that you might have in the historical record.
Before we get to how the research was done and some of the specific things that you found, how much is known about how long the Calusa had been there at that point? Do we have good understanding of how long the Calusa had been around, or are there just not records, so it's quite speculative?
We have done a little bit of archaeological work there, and that's been reported earlier in some papers. But in a nutshell, we believe that the island was inhabited as early as about 400 A.D., so about 1,600 years ago. The first occupation of the island was probably people who were fishing and gathering and eating oysters and depositing the oysters in this particular place. And over a long period of time, the island built up and it was quite a large settlement. Later, we know that the Calusa actually heaped up old material that had been accumulating for many years, oysters and dirt and bones and other detritus. They heaped up these things in particular mounds so that they would have places to build houses and do various things. So there's both rather haphazard accumulation of materials going on there, probably early on, and then later, at least in part, a reuse of those discarded materials to build predetermined mounds that then could have structures on top of them.
So how did you guys conduct this research? I understand you both did actual digging, but also used some, ground-penetrating radar or something along those lines?
Yes, ground-penetrating radar was an important part of our research. We have by no means covered the entire island or any of the areas that we're truly interested in, but we have done ground-penetrating radar in some areas, and we had identified what we believed substantial walls, small ones, smaller ones, and larger ones. And so that had happened in an earlier visit to the island. So we determined that we would come back in spring and summer there of 2017 to digging and see if we could find out whether this was the remnants of the Fort San Antón. And that did turn out to be correct. Ground-penetrating radar is a way of sending signals down into the ground, and basically the pattern of the echo tells you what could be down there. But that's no substitute for digging. You still got to do some excavation to see if what you think is down there really is and what it could be. So it's really kind of a two-step process.
So let me ask you this. So we live here in Florida, where everything's very flat. The sea level's very low. The Calusa were building mounds to get up higher. How did the walls that the Spanish built wind up below the ground? Does that question make sense?
The island has been used by other people for long periods of time after the Calusa were there. The Crescians, for example, they were pioneer era agricultures were there, so it's just a natural oil form. In fact, the walls that we found of the fort were just a few inches under the ground, literally inches down.
Huh. And you could just tell that they were Spanish by the fact that they weren't built in the same way that Calusa made things there, where they had some sort of distinguishing characteristics?
Well, one of the characteristics that was surprising to us was that we could identify a kind of primitive tabby, it's called, which is a concrete that's made out of oyster shells and other materials. So these weren't really concrete walls in the sense that you would see an entire wall of shells, but what you see is posts or remains of posts, places where posts were, and those posts are often surrounded by this tabby sort of concrete. And tabby is made by burning oyster shells, and this creates lime. And then you mix that with water and ash and broken shells, and it provides something that hardens. Now, this is to be distinguished from the kind of tabby that was made much later on by the Spaniards, but also later adopted by the English in their plantations. And in that case, they're pouring concrete in molds and really building very strong walls of plantation houses and slave cabins and so forth. This is not that sort of thing, but it is a primitive kind of tabby. Clouser were not building with tabby. They were building with their houses or wood and thatch structures, and they brought in a lot of wood from other places, other islands, or the mainland, and built this large house of the king, which we identified, and we have another paper on that. They were building with wood and thatch, but the Spaniards reinforced their structures, both the wall of the fort and the individual houses, which we intersected two houses inside. And they are built with this technique of using posts with a crude kind of tabby around the posts. But you can imagine, you know, if you could put a mailbox in, you know, if you're going to put a mailbox in by the road, and you can just dig a hole and stick the mailbox post in, right? Or you can dig a bigger hole, put the post in, and then pour concrete around the post of the mailbox, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cover it over. In the second case, the concrete would form a more firm foundation and would be harder to knock over the mailbox. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's that sort of thing.
Hmm. So how big do you think or do you know this fort would have been? And how many people would have been living in it?
The Spaniards built their fort with posts and these reinforced post walls. And there were 36 structures inside it, at least at the beginning. We don't know how big those structures are. We know that the wall is substantial, and we can trace it a little bit, just kind of seeing it on the surface now that we know kind of where it is. But it was fairly substantial. And so that's not a very good quantification. What does fairly substantial mean? I don't know. But it's more than what we've excavated so far, and it would be really wonderful to do some more work out there and to explore that some more.
Is there any understanding of how many people would have been living there?
It's a little hard to answer that question because it was occupied by a certain number of soldiers and religious people, priests, at the beginning. And then later, there was so much hostility against the Spaniards by the South Florida Indian people that the fort in the Tampa Bay area was closed, and the fort in the Miami area was closed. And anyone who lived in those forts came to, so they got even more people there.
Hmm.
We don't know that the walls were expanded. We don't think it got any bigger, but it got more people.
You alluded to the fact that things turned out poorly in terms of the relationship between the Spanish and the Calusa or the Indians in Florida, but was there a time when they first arrived that they got along better?
Well, I don't think they ever completely trusted one another, but they were placed in a position where each needed the other to try to make a deal. The Spaniards wanted to eventually colonize the area. They felt they had a mandate to convert the Indians to Christianity, and they wanted to pacify the Indians. But Carlos, the king of the Calusa at that time, 1566, was in the midst of a very hostile situation with Tocobaga, who lived in the Tampa Bay area. He was a rival for people and for resources and for trade that was going on in the broader southeastern United States. And so Carlos saw Menendez as a possible ally, that he would swear his allegiance to Menendez, and then in return Menendez would help him fight his enemies and help him defeat Tocobaga and become more powerful. But Menendez foiled this plan by trying to make peace between Calusa and Tocobaga, and then Carlos lost face with his people. And so he turned against the Spaniards because it didn't turn out the way he wanted it to. And so he plotted to try to remove the Spaniards or even kill Menendez and others. At which point, his cousin Felipe, what the Spaniards called Felipe, betrayed Carlos. Carlos was attracted to the fort. He came for his people were killed, assassinated by the Spanish, and they put on the throne. He became the king of South Florida. And so initially, Felipe tried to play ball with the Spaniards and say that he would become a Christian. But that didn't last long either. He incurred the wrath of his people and other people in South Florida who thought it was not a good idea to cooperate with the Spaniards. And then ultimately the Spaniards assassinated him. So at that point, the Clusa had just had enough, and they left the island. One account says that they burned their houses and left the island. So now you can imagine that Spaniards have been left alone on the island. There's nobody to do work for them, nobody to bring them food. And so they left the island as well in June of 1569. So hostility is sort of an understatement. There was some deal-making that was done with the Spaniards and the Clusa trying to make a deal to see if they could figure out a way that would be a mutual benefit, but it didn't work out at all. The Spaniards had a different agenda. The Clusa were true to their own beliefs and their own way of life. They didn't want to become agriculturists. They were fishing people. They didn't want to grow corn or anything that the Spaniards wanted them to do, and they certainly didn't want to become Catholics. So it was just a situation that nobody could win.
Huh. That is a really fascinating little bit of trivia history for us here in Southwest Florida. The Clusa left because they couldn't put up with the Spanish, and then the Spanish left because they couldn't live here without the Clusa. There's something really interesting about that.
That is exactly what happened.
Huh. You just mentioned, you know, how the Clusa, they were, they were fishermen and fisherwomen. One of the things that came up in reading the article that was in the Florida Museum story was these ideas of water courts. I don't think I'd ever heard that, like fish corrals. Can you talk some about what those were? And is that something you've discovered most recently, or is that something we've known about?
Yeah, water courts are rectangular structures that the Indians constructed that are about 3 feet high, and the walls of them are about 3 feet high. And we believe that they were used for capturing fish or storing fish, at least short term. And we were not the first people to suggest that this was a possibility. But again, nobody had really looked into them and put a trench through the walls of these structures and intensively looked to see how they were constructed. And so we were able to determine that they were indeed specifically built around 1400 or so AD, at a time when the Clusa were dealing with large populations and probably were intensifying their fishing techniques. And so they needed more fish for more people. They had relationships with other people throughout Florida. So they were accumulating a surplus by drying and smoking and eating or trading fish. So this is published on last year, and I can send you that paper as well.
It sounds like we'll have to have you back to talk about all the different things that's come out of this research that you guys have been doing. There's so many aspects to it that are fascinating that have all come out at once.
Yeah, that's the thing. It looks like that we just suddenly published a bunch of stuff, woke up one day and published, but in fact this has been going on for several years, and this just happens that the papers are coming out at this particular time. Why don't I send you some other things, and if you at some point want to talk to Victor or me or Amanda or any of the other people associated with the project, Mike Savarese right there in town does some wonderful work. He's part of our team. So there's a lot to talk about. If you are interested later on.
Absolutely. We can do a whole series of these. This is the first show that we've done, by the way, that's not COVID-19 related for the last 6 weeks. So it's kind of nice to talk to somebody about something else. So it's really just nice. It's just nice to have a conversation about something else.
Well, I'm glad to brighten your day. It certainly is fun to talk to you. And I really do encourage you to talk to Victor. He's got some great ideas. I really enjoyed working with him. It's a University of Georgia, University of Florida, Florida Museum of Natural History, and Florida Gulf Coast University team. And also Lee Newsom, who works at Flagler College. She's an archaeobotanist. It's just been a wonderful team to work with. And, you know, when you have a bunch of people with different expertise all kind of working together, you learn a lot more than you would if you're just doing it by yourself.
Dr. Bill Marquard is Curator Emeritus at the Florida Museum of Natural History. Dr. Marquard, thanks so much for your time.
I'm glad to talk to you. Take care.
If you missed any of today's show, you can always see your episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. And do stay tuned for future episodes when we explore this research further, including more about the extensive use of water courts, the scope of the Colusa King's House, and whether Estero Island was a possible satellite village of Mound Key. Today's show was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.